A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Most people hear depression and picture someone crying in bed, curtains drawn. And for a lot of people, that's exactly what it looks like. But for a whole lot of others, depression looks like someone screaming at a minivan in the school drop-off line, or snapping at their spouse because the dishwasher was loaded wrong.
The clinical image versus the lived reality. They've been drifting apart for decades, and nobody really updated the textbook photos.
Daniel sent this one in. He's pointing back to something we touched on before, that in new fathers especially, irritability and anger can be more reliable depression signals than sadness is. And he's asking the bigger question. Does depression actually manifest as anger in specific subtypes? And how common is that compared to the quintessential sad, weepy presentation everyone expects?
This is one of those questions where the answer changes depending on whether you're reading the diagnostic manual or actually treating patients. The DSM-5 says depression requires depressed mood or loss of interest. Anger isn't listed as a core symptom for adults. But the CDC put out a report in June of 2025 showing a 37% increase in anger-related mental health complaints among men aged 25 to 44 since 2020. And our screening tools still don't ask about it.
37%. That's not noise.
It's not noise, and the PHQ-9, the standard depression screener most primary care doctors hand you, contains exactly zero items about anger or irritability. So you've got this enormous signal showing up in emergency rooms and crisis lines, and the instrument we use to catch depression is deliberately not looking at it.
Like a smoke detector that only listens for sobbing.
That's exactly what it is, and we've known about this disconnect for a while. The clinical construct of mass depression dates back to the 1960s. A Swiss psychiatrist named Paul Kielholz described patients whose depression presented as irritability, aggression, even physical complaints, with no subjective sadness at all. The concept got dismissed for decades, partly because it was tangled up with some genuinely sexist assumptions. But modern neuroimaging has brought it back in a more rigorous form.
The idea has been floating around psychiatry for 60 years, and we're still not screening for it.
That's the practical tension in Daniel's question. What percentage of depressed patients are walking around looking angry rather than sad? The best data we have is a 2023 meta-analysis by Fava and colleagues in JAMA Psychiatry. 34% of patients with major depressive disorder reported significant irritability or anger. But only 12% had it as their primary presenting symptom. So it's common, but it's usually mixed with other things.
Still, 1 in 3. That's not some edge case.
Right. And the gender split is interesting. Women with depression are about twice as likely to report sadness as the primary symptom. Men are about 1.8 times more likely to report anger. But here's the kicker. That gap narrows substantially when you control for social desirability bias in self-reporting. In other words, women experience angry depression too, but they're socialized to describe it differently, and clinicians are socialized to hear it differently.
The angry man stereotype of depression might be partly an artifact of who feels allowed to admit they're angry.
And that's one of the things I want to dig into, what's actually happening in the brain when depression roots through the anger circuitry instead of the sadness circuitry, and why the same underlying condition can produce such different emotional signatures.
That's where we should go next. But first, let me just name the thing that bothers me most about this. The cultural image of depression as quiet, passive suffering. That image has real consequences. If you're a construction foreman who's been sleeping 4 hours a night, can't focus, has lost interest in everything, but your main subjective experience is that you want to punch a wall, you're not going to recognize yourself in the Zoloft commercial. And neither will the people around you. They'll just think you've become a jerk.
That exact case shows up in the literature. There's a well-known case study of a 34-year-old construction foreman who came in for anger management after a road rage incident. He scored a 28 on the PHQ-9, That's severe depression territory, but he endorsed zero sadness items. His symptoms were all irritability, sleep disturbance, and concentration problems. If the clinician had only asked about mood, they'd have missed it entirely.
28 on the PHQ-9 with zero sadness. That's almost a different condition, phenotypically.
That's the question, isn't it? Is this a different condition, or is it the same condition expressing itself through a different emotional channel? The neurobiology suggests something interesting. It might come down to which circuits get disrupted first. Low serotonin affects the orbitofrontal cortex, which is your impulse-controlled brake pedal. In some people, that manifests as mood dysregulation. In others, it manifests as disinhibition, the inability to suppress aggressive impulses that a healthy brain would filter out.
It's not that they're sad and expressing it as anger. The sadness circuitry might not even be the part that's broken.
That's the disinhibition hypothesis, and it would explain why these patients often don't feel sad when you ask them. They're not sad. They're irritable, they're exhausted, they can't sleep, they've lost interest in everything, but the dominant emotional note isn't sorrow. It's frustration with extremely low threshold.
Which makes them delightful to be around, I'm sure.
It's actually one of the reasons these patients often present later and with more severe symptoms. Nobody stages an intervention for, "You seem really irritable lately." They stage interventions for crying.
We're worried about you. You've been a complete nightmare.
The social response to anger is withdrawal, not concern. So the support systems that might catch classic depression don't activate.
That's before we even get into the treatment implications.
The STAR-D trial data is fascinating on this. Patients with high irritability scores at baseline had 40% lower remission rates on citalopram alone. So not only are we failing to screen for this presentation, the first-line treatment we default to might be the wrong one.
40% lower. That's a number that should be changing clinical practice, and I suspect it isn't.
It isn't. But let's come back to that. I want to start with what's actually happening upstream. The neurobiology of why depression roots through anger, the cortisol-testosterone interaction, and that whole masked depression history you mentioned.
Before we do, one more thing about the CDC number. 37% increase in anger-related mental health complaints among men, 25 to 44. That's prime fatherhood age. And we know from Paulson and Bazemore's 2010 analysis that 8 to 10% of new fathers experience postpartum depression, and in 62% of those cases, the primary symptom is irritability, not sadness. So this isn't just an academic question about diagnostic categories. There's a specific population where the mismatch between symptoms and screening tools is basically guaranteeing misdiagnoses.
That's where Daniel's original observation came from, the New Fathers episode. He noticed that the anger presentation wasn't just a footnote. It was the main event for a majority of the men who were depressed. And he's asking whether that pattern shows up in other populations too.
Let's answer that. Neurobiology first, then we can trace it through the clinical picture.
Let's start with serotonin, because that's where most people's mental model begins. Serotonin does a lot of things. Mood regulation is the one everyone knows. But one of its less famous jobs is modulating impulse control through the orbitofrontal cortex. The orbitofrontal cortex sits right behind your eyebrows, and it's essentially the brain's executive brake system. When it's working properly, you feel a flash of irritation and your brain says, "Not worth it, let it go." When serotonin signaling is low, that brake gets spongy.
The impulse fires and nothing catches it.
And this is where the disinhibition hypothesis gets traction. In some depressed patients, the primary deficit isn't in the mood regulation circuitry, it's in the impulse control circuitry. They're not experiencing more anger than a healthy person. They're experiencing the same flashes of irritation everyone gets, but the filter that normally suppresses them isn't functioning. So, every minor frustration registers as a major provocation.
Which would explain why these patients often describe themselves as not depressed, just angry all the time. They're not misidentifying sadness. They aren't sad. They're experiencing a failure of inhibition.
And there's neuroimaging work that supports this. Functional MRI studies show that when you provoke anger in healthy subjects, the orbitofrontal cortex lights up as it works to regulate the response. In depressed patients with high irritability, that activation is significantly blunted. The brake isn't engaging.
It's not that depression makes you angry. It's that depression removes the thing that stops you from being angry.
That's one pathway. But there's also a second mechanism that's more about the stress hormone system. Chronic stress elevates cortisol, and cortisol and testosterone have a complicated relationship. In some people, and this is more common in men, though not exclusive, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis response to chronic stress produces a cortisol-testosterone interaction that drives irritability rather than lethargy.
Walk me through that. I always thought high cortisol just burn you out into a puddle.
That's the typical picture. The adrenal fatigue model, cortisol burnout, can't get out of bed. But the HPA axis doesn't respond the same way in everyone. In some individuals, chronic stress creates a state of hyperarousal rather than hypoarousal. Cortisol stays elevated, testosterone doesn't suppress the way it does in classic depression, and the result is a kind of agitated, irritable, keyed-up depression that looks nothing like the person who can't get off the couch.
Two different biological pathways can produce what looks like the same angry presentation. One through serotonin and disinhibition, one through cortisol and hyperarousal.
They probably have different treatment implications, which we'll get to. But the key point is that angry depression isn't one thing biologically. It's at least two things, maybe more, that happen to converge on a similar behavioral output.
Which makes the diagnostic question even trickier. If the same symptom can arise from different mechanisms, a screening tool that just asks, "Are you irritable?" might not be enough. You'd need to know what kind of irritable.
That's exactly where the research is heading. But let me pull on the historical thread for a second, because it's relevant to why we're so bad at recognizing this. In 1973, Paul Kielholz published a major paper on what he called masked depression, depressive states where the emotional experience of sadness was hidden behind other symptoms. Irritability, aggression, somatic complaints, even what looked like hypochondria. His argument was that these were genuine depressive presentations that were being missed because clinicians were looking for the wrong thing.
This got rejected?
It got complicated. The concept was taken up by some clinicians in ways that were problematic. There was a period where masked depression became a catch-all diagnosis for any behavior in men that seemed off. And it was used to dismiss women's legitimate anger as really just depression. The feminist critique of psychiatry in the 70s and 80s pointed out, correctly, that labeling women's anger as depression was a way of pathologizing reasonable responses to injustice.
The baby went out with the bathwater.
The entire concept of depression presenting without sadness got tainted by association with bad clinical practice. And it wasn't until functional neural imaging came along in the 2000s that researchers could say, actually, there's a biological basis for this. Can we talk about it again without the sexist baggage?
The modern version is what? Externalizing depression?
That's one term. Depression with anger attacks is another, and that one has a specific clinical meaning. In 1990, Fava, the same Fava who did the 2023 analysis, published the first systematic description of anger attacks in depression. These are sudden, disproportionate rage episodes that come out of nowhere, last maybe 10 or 15 minutes, and then subside, leaving the person confused and guilty. They look structurally like panic attacks, but the dominant affect is aggression rather than fear.
That's a vivid clinical picture. Someone who's fine, 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 and then suddenly screaming at a cashier over a coupon.
They don't know why. That's the hallmark. The person experiencing the anger attack recognizes that the response is disproportionate, but they can't stop it. It's ego dystonic. They're watching themselves lose control, and they hate it.
Which would be terrifying, actually. To feel like your emotional responses have been hijacked.
That's often what brings them into treatment. Not, I'm depressed, but I'm losing my mind. I screamed at my kid for spilling milk and I couldn't stop. The guilt afterward is enormous, and that guilt can feed back into the depression in a nasty cycle.
How common are anger attacks specifically, versus just general irritability?
The 2023 FAVA analysis found that about 30 to 40% of depressed patients experience some form of anger attack during their depressive episodes. But only about 12 to 15% have them as a prominent recurrent feature. So it's not rare, but it's also not the majority presentation.
The 12% who have it as their primary symptom, those are the ones most likely to be completely missed by standard screening.
Because if your PHQ-9 asks, over the past 2 weeks, have you felt down, depressed, or hopeless? And have you had little interest or pleasure in doing things? And you answer no to both, the clinician might stop there. But you could have severe depression manifesting entirely as anger attacks, sleep disruption, and concentration problems, and the PHQ-9 would give you a score of 0 on those first two gatekeeper items.
You'd screen negative for depression while having a depressive episode, severe enough to be destroying your marriage.
That's not a hypothetical. That's exactly what happened with the construction foreman case. PHQ-9, total score of 28, but 0 on the sadness items. If the clinician had stopped after the first two questions, that patient walks out with no diagnosis and no treatment.
Let's talk about what does catch this. You mentioned the irritability questionnaire and the anger attacks questionnaire.
The irritability questionnaire, or IRQ, was developed specifically to capture this dimension. It asks about things like, have you been easily annoyed by small things? Have you had temper outbursts that felt out of proportion? Have you felt like you might lose control and hurt someone or break something? The anger attacks questionnaire is more specific. It looks for those discrete episodes of sudden rage, and it asks about physical symptoms, like heart pounding, trembling, feeling hot, which helps distinguish anger attacks from general irritability.
These are validated instruments.
They are, but here's the problem. They're not in standard use. Your primary care doctor has never heard of them. Even most psychiatrists don't use them routinely. They're research tools that haven't made the jump to clinical practice.
We have validated instruments that would catch the 12 to 34% of depressed patients who present with anger rather than sadness, and nobody uses them.
That's the state of play, and it connects directly to the treatment problem. If you don't identify the anger presentation, you're likely to reach for first-line SSRIs like sertraline or citalopram. And for a subset of these patients, SSRIs can actually make things worse.
How does an antidepressant make anger worse?
It's a side effect that's under discussed, a feeling of inner restlessness, agitation, and inability to sit still. In some patients, especially those with the hyperarousal type of depression, SSRIs can trigger or worsen akathisia, and that agitation can express itself as increased irritability and even aggression. There are case reports of patients with angry depression who got significantly worse on sertraline before being switched to something else.
The first-line treatment for depression can be actively harmful for this presentation.
In a minority of cases, yes. And the STAR-D trial found that patients with high irritability scores at baseline had 40% lower remission rates on citalopram alone. That's not a subtle difference. That's a signal that this subgroup needs something different.
What do they respond to instead?
The data suggests SNRIs like venlafaxine or duloxetine tend to work better for the angry depression subtype. Bupropion also shows promise, partly because it works on dopamine and norepinephrine rather than serotonin, and partly because it tends to be more activating, which sounds counterintuitive for someone who's already agitated, but the mechanism seems to be different. There's also some evidence that mood stabilizers and atypical antipsychotics used as augmentation can help with the anger attacks specifically.
You've got a patient who walks in, they're irritable, they're not sleeping, they've lost interest in things, they don't feel sad. Standard screener misses them. If they do get diagnosed, the first-line SSRI might make them worse or just not work. And the drugs that would work aren't typically first-line.
That's the clinical pathway for a lot of these patients. They cycle through one or two SSRIs, get labeled treatment-resistant, and only then does someone think to try a different class of medication. Meanwhile, they've been suffering for months or years, and their relationships have taken serious damage.
That's assuming they even make it to a psychiatrist. The construction foreman probably goes to his primary care doctor, if he goes at all.
The primary care doctor has 7 minutes, a PHQ-9, and a prescription pad. That's the funnel.
What's the fix? Add 2 questions to the screener.
That's actually one of the most practical proposals in the literature. Add 2 questions to any depression assessment. In the past 2 weeks, have you felt easily annoyed or angered? And had you had episodes of anger that felt out of proportion to the situation? Those 2 questions alone would catch most of the externalizing depression cases that currently slip through.
That's it.
And the DSM-6 should probably consider adding irritability as a core symptom for adult depression. It's already recognized for children and adolescents. For pediatric depression, irritability can substitute for depressed mood in the diagnostic criteria. But at age 18, it magically stops counting. That makes no sense neurobiologically.
The brain doesn't check a calendar and switch symptom profiles at midnight on your 18th birthday.
The continuity argument is strong. If irritability is a valid depressive symptom in a 17-year-old, it doesn't suddenly become invalid at 18. The DSM just drew an arbitrary line.
To pull back and answer the question directly, does depression manifest as anger in specific subtypes? It sounds like the answer is yes, at least two. The serotonin disinhibition type and the cortisol hyperarousal type, possibly more. And how common is it? About a third of depressed patients have significant irritability, and about 1 in 8 have it as their dominant symptom.
That's the headline. And the gender story is more complicated than men get angry, women get sad. Both genders experience angry depression, but reporting biases and social expectations create an artificial gap in the data.
Which means clinicians need to ask about anger in everyone, not just in men they suspect of male depression.
The angry presentation crosses gender lines. The difference is in who feels comfortable reporting it.
There's a broader point here about how we culturally construct the deserving depressed person. The weeping person in bed evokes sympathy and concern. The irritable person evokes avoidance and judgment. One gets casseroles, the other gets divorced.
That's not just a social observation. It has treatment implications. The patient who presents with sadness gets a different clinical response than the patient who presents with anger. The angry patient is more likely to be seen as difficult, personality disordered, or just unpleasant. Clinicians are human. They react differently to someone who's crying in their office versus someone who's pacing and snapping.
The patient who's snapping might not even recognize themselves as depressed. They might think they've just become a worse person.
That's one of the most heartbreaking parts of this. The construction foreman in the case study didn't come in saying, "I think I'm depressed." He came in saying, "I have anger problems, I'm ruining my life, I don't know what's wrong with me." He had constructed an entire narrative about being a bad person before anyone suggested it might be a treatable medical condition.
That narrative sticks. Even after treatment, I'd imagine there's a lot of guilt to work through about the things you said and did while you were symptomatic.
That's where the therapy piece comes in. Medication can address the neurobiological drivers, but there's usually a layer of shame and relationship damage that needs to be processed. Cognitive behavioral therapy can help with the automatic thoughts that trigger anger spirals, and couples therapy is often necessary because the partner has been on the receiving end of months or years of irritability.
The treatment isn't just take this pill and you'll be nicer. There's cleanup work.
Significant cleanup work. And that's another reason early detection matters. The longer the anger presentation goes unrecognized, the more relational damage accumulates, and the harder the full recovery becomes.
We've laid out the scope of the problem, the neurobiology, the prevalence, the screening gap. I want to get into the treatment differentials in more detail, because the STAR-D findings deserve more airtime, and I think there's something important about how SNRIs versus SSRIs interact with the anger circuitry specifically.
Let's do that, and I want to connect this back to the new father's context that prompted the question, because the postpartum depression in men data is striking. 8-10% prevalence, 62% primarily irritable presentation, and that's a population that's almost never screened.
We've got two directions to go, the treatment specifics and the new father's piece.
Let's take the treatment side first. The STAR-D trial was designed to figure out what to do when first-line antidepressants don't work. Over 4,000 patients, multiple treatment steps, real-world clinical settings. And one of the secondary analyses looked at baseline irritability as a predictor of outcomes.
That's where the 40% number comes from.
40% lower remission on citalopram alone. But the interesting thing is what happened in the later steps. When patients with high irritability were switched to or augmented with medications that work on norepinephrine, so SNRIs like venlafaxine or bupropion, which works on dopamine and norepinephrine, the remission gap narrowed significantly.
It's not that these patients are treatment-resistant in general. They're specifically less responsive to pure serotonin reuptake inhibition.
Which makes sense if the underlying mechanism is partly about norepinephrine and dopamine circuits. Norepinephrine is heavily involved in arousal and attention. In the hyperarousal subtype of angry depression, the norepinephrine system might be dysregulated in a way that serotonin alone can't fix. Adding an SNRI addresses both serotonin and norepinephrine.
Bupropion's dopamine effect. What's the mechanism there?
Dopamine is involved in reward processing and motivation. One theory is that in angry depression, the irritability is partly driven by a kind of frustrated anhedonia. The patient can't experience pleasure or reward from things that should be rewarding, and that constant low-grade frustration expresses as irritability. Bupropion boosts dopamine signaling, which might restore some of that reward sensitivity.
Venlafaxine for the hyperarousal type, bupropion for the anhedonia-driven irritability.
Though in practice, a lot of clinicians end up using both, an SNRI plus bupropion augmentation for treatment-resistant cases. And there's growing interest in using low-dose atypical antipsychotics like aripiprazole as augmentation specifically for the anger attacks. The evidence is still preliminary, but the early data looks promising.
The akathisia problem with SSRIs, how common is that?
Hard to pin down precisely because it's underreported, but estimates range from 5 to 25% of patients on SSRIs experience some degree of akathisia. Most cases are mild, a feeling of restlessness, can't sit still, jittery. But in a small percentage, it's severe, and in the angry depression subgroup, that restlessness can cross over into agitation and aggression.
The clinician sees patient got worse on antidepressant and might conclude the depression is treatment-resistant rather than recognizing it's an adverse reaction.
That's exactly the clinical pitfall. And the patient might not report it clearly. They might just say, I feel worse, or I feel like I'm crawling out of my skin. And if the clinician isn't attuned to akathisia as a possibility, they might increase the dose instead of switching medications.
Which would make it worse.
Which would make it much worse. There are case reports of akathisia-induced aggression that resolved immediately when the SSRI was discontinued. It's rare, but it's serious enough that every clinician prescribing SSRIs should know to watch for it.
The practical takeaway for clinicians is screen for anger and irritability up front. If you find it, consider starting with an SNRI or bupropion rather than an SSRI. And if a patient on an SSRI reports feeling more agitated, take akathisia seriously as a possible cause.
That's a solid clinical algorithm. And for patients and families, the takeaway is unexplained irritability, especially if it comes with sleep changes, fatigue, or loss of interest, might be depression. Don't wait for sadness to show up before you take it seriously.
Which brings us back to new fathers. Because that's a population where everyone expects joy and bonding, and the actual experience for 10% of them is irritability, withdrawal, and a sense that something is wrong, but they don't know what.
The Paulson and Bazemore analysis from 2010 is still the best data we have on this. 8 to 10% of new fathers experience postpartum depression. The peak onset is actually slightly later than for mothers, typically 3 to 6 months after birth, rather than the first few weeks. And in 62% of cases, the primary symptom is irritability, not sadness.
62%? That's almost two-thirds. So the typical presentation of paternal postpartum depression is not a sad dad. It's an angry dad.
Think about the social context. A new mother who's crying and can't get out of bed triggers alarm bells. There are screening programs, public health campaigns, everyone's watching for it. A new father who's irritable and withdrawn and working late and snapping at his wife. That's not read as depression. That's read as him being a bad partner and a disengaged father.
The casserole test. Nobody's bringing a casserole for the guy who yelled about the diaper pail.
The marriage takes the hit. Maternal postpartum depression is awful, but at least it's recognized as a medical condition. Paternal postpartum depression is often experienced by the family as a character flaw. The wife doesn't think my husband is depressed. She thinks my husband doesn't love me or the baby.
Which then creates secondary depression in the mother. And you got two depressed parents and a newborn.
The research bears that out. Paternal depression is a strong predictor of maternal depression and vice versa. The couple's mental health is a system, not two independent variables. When the father's depression manifests as anger and withdrawal, it puts enormous strain on the mother, who's already hormonally vulnerable.
Screening for paternal depression isn't just about helping fathers. It's about protecting the whole family system.
The screening tools are the same problem we've been talking about. The Edinburgh Postnatal Depression Scale, which is the standard postpartum screener, was developed for mothers. It asks about sadness, tearfulness, anxiety. It doesn't ask about anger. So when you screen fathers with it, you're going to miss the majority of the ones who are depressed.
Has anyone developed a paternal postpartum depression screener?
There are some research instruments. The Gotland Male Depression Scale was developed in Sweden and includes items about irritability, stress tolerance, and aggressive behavior. It's not specific to the postpartum period, but it's better at catching the male typical presentation. The problem is, it's not in wide clinical use.
To summarize where we are, we have a common depression presentation that affects about a third of patients, is the dominant presentation in about 1 in 8, and is the majority presentation in new fathers. Our standard screening tools don't catch it. Our first-line treatment sometimes makes it worse, and the social response to the symptoms is judgment rather than support.
That's a fair summary, and the fixes are not complicated. Two screening questions. Awareness that SNRIs and bupropion might be better first choices for this presentation. And public education that depression doesn't always look like sadness.
It's almost frustrating how simple the fixes are relative to the scale of the problem.
That's a lot of mental health care, honestly. The gap between what we know and what we do is enormous.
Let me ask the forward-looking question. You mentioned the DSM-6 potentially adding irritability as a core symptom for adults. What's the timeline on that? And is there actually movement in that direction?
The DSM-6 is probably still 7 to 10 years out. The revision process is glacial by design. But there's active discussion in the working groups about dimensional approaches to diagnosis, moving away from categorical, you have it or you don't, toward spectrums that capture symptom diversity. Irritability as a transdiagnostic dimension is one of the proposals on the table. The Research Domain Criteria Framework from the National Institute of Mental Health has been pushing in this direction for years.
The digital phenotyping angle. You mentioned wearable devices potentially detecting this through voice tone and heart rate variability.
That's emerging work. The MIT Media Lab's Affective Computing Group has been developing algorithms that can detect changes in vocal prosody, the rhythm, pitch, and tone of speech that correlate with depressive states, including the irritable subtype. Heart rate variability patterns also differ between the hyperarousal and hyperarousal types of depression. The idea is that your smartwatch might one day notice you're getting more irritable before you do.
That's either brilliant or terrifying, depending on how you feel about your smartwatch.
The technology's not there yet, but the signal is real. The question is whether we build systems that use it well.
Which is a whole other episode. But for now, I think the takeaway is simpler than the neuroscience. If you or someone around you is inexplicably angry, don't rule out depression just because they're not crying.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1810s, a beekeeper on Kiritimati Island in Kiribati produced what is believed to be the smallest recorded harvest of coconut palm honey, just under 3 fluid ounces from an entire season's yield, making it the most labor-to-honey inefficient apicultural operation ever documented in the Pacific.
I have so many questions about the economics of that operation. This has been my Weird Props. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the show running, and to everyone who listens and argues with us in their car. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people find the show. Find more at myweirdprompts.com.
I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Talk to you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.